This talk was given by Patrick Yunan Kelly at the Zen Center of New York City. Yunan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ccnyc. Thanks for listening.
So good morning. Am I doing everything right with this? Can people hear me in the back? Speak louder or turn up the volume? Okay. Yeah, it sounds like that's a little better. Okay. So good morning. My name is Yunan. I'm a senior lay student here in the Mountains and Rivers Order. And as Taikyo said, I've practiced some at the monastery, but a lot of my training, probably most of it, has been here at the temple. So it's a delight, a somewhat anxiety-producing delight, but it's a delight to be up here giving a talk. I haven't done this before, so. So I wanted to talk about today what may be a little bit of a, I don't actually think of it as a heavy topic, but it may sound like a heavy topic. So the experience of desolation, or these desert places that we come across in practice. So let me just kick things off with this poem. This is by a woman named Izumi Shikibu, who was a Japanese poet in the Heian court. So this is around the 10th or 11th century. And so she wrote, "Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight shines between the roof planks of this ruined house." So one more time. "Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight shines between the roof planks of this ruined house." And so I said when I started out that we come across these places of difficulty or desolation in practice. And this is not just practice, of course. This is just part of the human world. This is what we experience. But there's something about the way that we come across them in practice, and that we actually, we're turning towards these things. Normally, this is like the last thing in the world that we want to face. And we do everything we can to distract ourselves or to get away from it. But in practice, we're actually turning towards these things. This isn't just Buddhist practice. So in Christianity, for example, St. John of the Cross speaks of the dark night of the soul, or in the Book of Psalms, the psalmist speaks of the valley of the shadow of death. So this is what I'm trying to get at. It's a little bit weird. And the reason I want to speak about this is, and I feel like I'm in a tin can or something, which I guess is kind of what it feels like sometimes. But this is a real thing, and so it can be helpful to be aware of it, so that when we encounter it, you know, we can remind ourselves that this is just a part of the process. It's okay. We're human beings, and this is part of what it means to be a human being. Many other men and women who have taken up this practice in the past have experienced these things, and so we can perhaps turn to their stories, and that can be helpful. So, Trungpa Rinpoche famously advised people that they should be very careful about starting out on a spiritual path. He said, because if you do, you have to go all the way. And if you don't, if you turn aside at some point, you're going to be haunted by the unfinished business that you've left behind. But of course, when we start out, you know, we're a little bit brazen, and we just forge ahead anyway. A warning like that makes it a little bit more exciting, actually. I mean, that was my experience. You know, and then after a little while, you realize what the hell have I gotten myself into. And I'm speaking about this as in terms of beginning of practice and not, but I don't think this is something that happens at the beginning of practice. I think this happens all the way through from time to time. You know, we think that we have this idea when we start, we're gonna reach some place where I won't ever feel sad, or I won't ever feel angry again, or all my problems will go away, or I'll reach a place where, you know, one day if I just really, you know, hack away at this, I'll achieve Anattara Samyak Sambodhi, and, you know, I'll be recognized as a great master. Everyone will acknowledge my profound wisdom and compassion, and everything will be fine. I mean, we laugh, but we know it's true. I mean, this is what we think, you know. I mean, I know that I do, and I really doubt that I'm the only one. So we begin. And this sort of, you know, fantasy that we're going after, it's actually very helpful. We need it, you know. It said, without painted hunger, you can't become a true person. So this is actually very helpful, and it's good that we have it. And it's not actually that we're not fundamentally wise and compassionate. We do. We are. We have that. That's our birthright. But it's just not in the way that we expect it. It's not going to turn out in the way that we expect it to turn out. There is a part of us that expects things to happen a certain way, but that person is going to be disappointed. You know, that person is toast in a way. And so as we get a sense of real practice, whether we just walked in the door, we've been doing this for 25 or 30 years, we come to a place where we feel like this is just not what I signed up for. Something's wrong here. And I don't mean to, you know, there may be situations, there are, in which you need to, you know, say something, or that's not what I'm talking about. I was thinking as I was writing this, I remembered this story of a woman who had been, when I was living at the monastery, she had been coming around a lot and doing sesshin and then spending a couple months in residency. And it seemed pretty clear that she was really interested in becoming a formal student and going through this process that we have. And then one morning, so at the end of sesshin, which is our week-long meditation intensive, we have this thing called open sosan where everyone who wants to can say a word or two about their experience. And she spoke up and said, you know, I've been investigating this for a while and I've realized that I can't do it. I'm not ready to jump into the fiery furnace of practice. I'm just too scared. I don't want to do it. I respect all of you who are doing it, but it's not for me. And then afterwards, I happened to be sitting next to her at the breakfast table. We were just chatting, and someone else, we got on the topic of what she said. And another person who was sitting with us, you know, said to her, what actually makes you think you're not already in the furnace? Which is, in my experience, you know, it's not a question of whether we're in the furnace or not, it's whether we actually are willing to see it. So I mentioned that the stories of the people, the men and women who have been through this before, can be helpful. And I wanted to just go to the story of the Buddha, because he in a way, he spoke of some of this. I think of the story of the Buddha sometimes in a sort of like schematic or maybe a little bit of a cartoon way, as or my own practice is starting out sort of like on a, you know, you're on the freeway, the state freeway, the interstate, and then after a while you turn off onto a county highway, and you go on that for a while. You turn off onto a small road and then into a dirt road, and then that ends, and so you stop the car, you get out, you go down the footpath for a while. And then after a while that ends, and you're just forging your way through the brambles. And then maybe you think, what am I doing? And you look around and there's brambles behind and brambles ahead, and the path is gone. And you're just in the brambles. And so, of course, the Buddha, you know, he was raised in this position of to be a king. So in this environment of power and privilege, and he left that, he renounced that in order to pursue his spiritual quest. And so he first practiced with several of the spiritual teachers who are active in that part of India at this time. And he attained what he realized their teachings rather quickly. He did that, but he was not satisfied with what he had attained. They offered him leadership of their community, and he said, "No, I'm not satisfied. This doesn't answer my questions." I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know, if you know, you go in there, you're working on Mu for 10 years, and Chugin says, "Okay, that's good. Why don't you go on to the," and you're like, but wait, I haven't seen anything. What are you talking about?" I mean, it's kind of remarkable that he did this, I think. And then he took up the practice of he was a forest ascetic for a number of years with a small group of people, and he practiced extreme austerities. He brought himself to the brink of death, actually. But then he realized that wasn't working either, and so he quit that. His other companions were disgusted with him. They thought, you know, ascetic Gautama has taken up a life of luxury. But he went ahead. And at the end, he was on his own, really. And he said, later on when he was teaching, he looked back on that period. He said, "I thought to myself, the loneliness of the forest is hard to bear. It is hard to take pleasure in being alone. When at night I stayed in such frightening and fearful places, I was filled with terror and panic." And so he's not just talking about the forest, obviously. So these places exist wherever someone turns toward their questions and begins to investigate. You encounter these things. But, you know, when we look at these stories, there's an aspect of them. Hojin and Shugen were both, I think, mentioned that there's a bit of a hazard in these stories. And so what I understand by that is that we know how they turned out, right? We know that the Buddha, went on to realize a profound awakening. But if you think in the midst of that, he had no idea. There was no Buddhism. There was no Buddhist tradition. There was no Buddhist Sangha that he was turning to. He was completely, in a sense, in the wilderness. And although we have these stories to rely on, which are very helpful, in a sense, none of these stories of these people who went before us is exactly going to match up to us. Our story has to be different. It's going to be different. We have to find our own way. And so in a sense, it's, we're doing this for the first time, you know, because I haven't traveled this path before. No one has, in a sense. It really is the first time. And so, you know, we can sometimes, maybe this is just part of this culture, we like to maybe sentimentalize or romanticize this taking one's own path. I don't know what the cliche is, are marching to a different drum, you know, expressing your unique individuality. And it's not that those things are wrong, but it doesn't really, in my experience, it's not like that when you're doing it. It's bewildering. We come face to face to the fact that everything that we cherish is going to elude our grasp. So, our possessions, our loved ones, our intellect, our spiritual attainment, our self, everything. We can't hold on to any of it. You know, when that really starts to hit home, it's completely devastating. And I think that's what, to go back to the poem that I started with, that's what she's talking about. "Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight shines through the roof planks of this ruined house." You know, she wrote this, she had a very dramatic life in the Japanese court, many, you know, scandalous liaisons, and she wrote many poems were incorporated into her letters. But as far as I'm aware, this poem was actually, she wrote it sort of towards the end of her life, more towards herself. It was in her diary. So how do you practice when you, so, okay, so you end up in this place, and you got yourself there, but you know, you may not want to admit that. So what do you do? How do you practice it? You know, I find it's easiest, you know, for me to just to keep it very simple. So I can just, you know, follow my breath. Just really pay attention to my breath, really experience it. Or if I need a little bit more form, I practice the four immeasurables, you know, and I direct it towards myself. May I be happy. May I be free from suffering. May I delight in the joy of others. May I be at ease. And not just, this isn't just repeating with the mouth, but you're really embodying these things. You have to really intend them. And it's, you know, you can do it towards other people too, but it's, we sometimes, I speaking for myself, it's easier to skip over oneself. It's not being selfish to direct this towards yourself, because you are a being, and your awakening is inextricably bound up with that of everything else. So it's not selfish to do this towards yourself. And so we practice it, but even in a deeper sense, we don't need to do anything at all, actually. You know, in the sutra that we studied a few angos ago, the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines, it says, the perfection of wisdom, Prajnaparamita, she does nothing about all dharmas. The moonlight shines through the roof planks. All we have to do is notice it. You know, we don't have to manufacture anything. You know, quite the opposite. This morning we chanted, the absolute light, luminous throughout the whole universe, unfathomable excellence pervading everywhere. When we get out of the way, we just notice it. Of course, it's hard to get out of the way. You know, when I imagine not doing anything, the first I was thinking, you know, what comes to mind? It's like sitting on the sofa with a beer and just, you know, hanging out. But that's sitting on the sofa with a beer. That's not doing anything. You know, Zazen is the closest I can get. But even then, most of the time I'm, you know, somewhere else. But, and I said we just notice this, what I'm calling the moonlight. But even that is too much, actually. I mean, the moonlight shines whether we notice it or not. It's important to me whether I notice it, but the moonlight just shines. That's just what it does. And then another point that I noticed that was coming up for me is when we get to these difficult places, you know, I study myself, and it's, we sometimes have this experience of embarrassment or shame, you know, when we have a difficult time, you know, as if there's something wrong with us for experiencing that or feeling that. But I don't think it is, or, you know, as if it's a sign of failure, but I don't think it is. It just means that we're human beings, that's all. You know, I was, again, thinking about some of these stories in the from the men and women in the past. You know, you look at the Pali Canon. I remember we were studying that several years ago, and it's like these people show up at a talk. They've never heard, who is this guy, the Buddha? They say he's wise. Okay, well, let's go listen to him. They show up at a talk, and it's like they get blasted by the Buddha ray. You know, like 500 of them become arhats all at once, you know. Or this is a story I remember a few years ago here. We used to have movie night when Shugan was living here. And we watched this Japanese movie of the life of Dogen. And of course, you know, the climactic moment in the movie is Dogen's great awakening when he's at the monastery of Tendo Nyojo in China. And so the original story goes, he's sitting there late into the night, they're all sitting, and the guy next to him falls asleep. And so Tendo Nyojo, the abbot, you know, takes out his sandal and whacks the guy in the back and says, you have to drop off body and mind. You know, what is this single-minded and intense sleeping that you're doing? And I don't know, we don't hear any more about the guy, so it may not have had much effect on that guy. But Dogen said that he dropped off body and mind, right? But in that, you know, so how are you going to depict that in a movie? So what happens is, you know, Dogen's sitting there in Zazen, and, you know, the guy gets whacked. The lights sort of fade off, and, you know, and then Dogen Zafu just ignites and just blasts off. And he's flying past the planets and the stars, you know, and then through all these swirling psychedelic paisley patterns. It's pretty dramatic stuff. And afterwards, Shogun's comment on that was, try not to take that too literally. And, but, you know, in the end, these desert places, these desolate places, they're also impermanent, you know? We're so attached to finding some situation, and we want to grab onto it and just stick with it, and something that we can know, you know? And we prefer, you know, if we had our druthers, it would be paradise. We would be in one of the highest, you know, dhyana, heaven realms. But that usually doesn't work out. So barring that, we're even willing to settle for some state of dissatisfaction that we know. And even some state of torment, if we know it, we're willing to settle for it most of the time. But fortunately, reality doesn't cooperate with us even in that. So we can't even hold on to that. You know, in the Zen tradition, in Zen lore, people often speak of the cave of the blue dragon. So the blue dragon is this, you know, this mythical being, this enlightened being. The dragon is a symbol of enlightenment. It's this really ferocious, fierce, snarling dragon that she holds in her claw, the jewel of enlightenment. And it's said that if you want to experience that for yourself, you have to come face to face with the dragon. So everything that you don't want to look at, you have to come face to face to it. And it's not like, you know, the story of St. George where you go after the dragon and you kill it. It's more that you have to get just close to the dragon, you know, realize that you are the dragon, actually. It was never anything different. You know, it's scary, but I'm not sure we have any other choice. You know, Dogen, in his beginning instructions on Zazen, the Fukan Zazengi, he says, "Please, honored followers of Zen, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not be fearful of the true dragon. Devote your energies to a way that directly indicates the absolute. Succeed to the legitimate lineage of the ancestor's samadhi. Constantly perform in such a manner, and you are assured of being such a person as they. Your treasure store will open of itself, and you will use it at will." So this treasure store, it's your birthright. It's my birthright. What all of the Buddha ancestors have, you and I also have. And in fact, we owe it to them to awaken, because until we do, they can't be fully realized. So by practicing, we're helping them to awaken. So they all depend on us. So please, honored followers of Zen, do not be fearful of the true dragon.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.